you. Thanks for coming out. We like to think of history as an eternal and immutable thing, like Mount Rushmore, but it turns out to be rather oddly malleable. It has moods and fashions and changes of heart. It's studded with misconceptions, if not outright fictions. The Pilgrims had never heard anyone mention Plymouth Rock, and George Washington had no particular grudge against cherry trees. Some of the lushest fictions grow up around our commemorations of the past, which reminds me of the hands-down best-ever library joke. A man walks into his local library and he asks the librarian, "Can you tell me why so many major Civil War battles were fought on national parkland?" When I told that joke to one of my children, she said, "You know, I always wondered growing up why American presidents were always born on long weekends." None of which begins to explain what we've done with one immutable truth. During the summer of 1692, upon much deliberation, the Massachusetts Bay Colony executed 19 people for witchcraft. Those innocent men and women, there were 14 women and 5 men, were convicted in a Salem, Massachusetts courtroom. They hanged several miles away on a spot, and this will tell you something about how the trials were viewed in their immediate aftermath, that we can locate only with a great deal of difficulty today. Sometimes it seems as if the trauma of an event can be measured by how long it takes us to commemorate it and by how thoroughly we manage to mangle it in the process. Because if you go back to Salem today to get a taste of that startling chapter in our history, you discover that the town has embraced its past with what you might call an uncommon fervor. In 1692, nearly 180 people were accused of witchcraft, but none was a pirate. One was a Harvard-educated minister, and another was the richest merchant in the town of Salem. For several hundred years, Salem did everything in its power to bury its history. As late as 1952, when Arthur Miller visited to research the Crucible, the subject of witchcraft was taboo. "You couldn't get anyone to say a word about it," complained Miller. The stigma finally lifted with the Salem filming of the ABC sitcom Bewitched. The conceit of that show, as some of you clearly remember, was that a modern housewife enjoyed supernatural powers and that when she twitched her nose, she could get the garage door to open or the vacuum cleaner to do the cleaning for her, much to the dismay of her long-suffering and very mortal husband. For various reasons, in 1970, it made sense to shoot a number of sitcom episodes in Salem, and that finally allowed the town to embrace its inglorious past. And here is how it did so. In 1992, it unveiled this gleaming memorial to Elizabeth Montgomery, the TV show's star, who had effectively laundered the history. And so over the next years, Salem vigorously rebranded itself. This is the newspaper masthead. This is last year's football team. I should ask, has any of you been to Salem ever? So you know what I'm talking about if you've been there at all recently. This is the police cruiser. I spent a long time photographing the badges on the policemen in town just because I couldn't believe my eyes, and I think they all thought I was vaguely demented because I kept taking pictures of their arms. Generally, Salem becomes Witch City. There are a lot of bumper stickers, as some of you have clearly seen before. It's amazing what you can do with the word witch. This is my favorite T-shirt. After Bewitched, a community of Wiccans established itself in Salem, which is today a particularly good place to buy crystals, or a broomstick, or a magic wand. It's an especially good place to get a tattoo. A witch museum opened in a former church, and the restored home of one of the 1692 witchcraft judges cast itself as the witch house. And of course, Halloween now belongs to Salem, where October 31st is a month-long celebration. Hundreds of thousands of people pack the streets this month. This is particularly ironic as the Puritans, and in 1692, nearly everyone in New England was a Puritan, had a horror of holidays. They had renounced Christmas and Saints' Days to wind up with a calendar that has been described as the dullest in Western civilization. In other words, you can leave Salem today without any hint of its actual history. What precisely did happen in 1692? Toward the end of January, after an especially Arctic winter, two little girls began to bark and yelp and shudder. They fell dumb, they seemed to fly across rooms. They lived in what was then known as Salem Village, a hamlet 5 miles down the road from Salem Town, and a community today known to its great relief as Danvers, Massachusetts. The girl's father and uncle was the village minister, Samuel Paris. For some time, he resisted what seemed to many village people to be the obvious diagnosis. 4 years earlier, a family of Boston children had suffered identical symptoms. They too had convulsed and had trouble doing their chores and seemed to fall into trances. And they accused a local woman of having cast a spell on them. She had hanged on Boston Common in November of 1688. That case was well known, probably as much to the Salem Village children as to their parents. After weeks of prayer, with no change in the girl's condition and no other viable explanation for it, it seemed clear that witchcraft was at work. The girl soon named names. 3 different women, they said, had enchanted them. And one of those women quickly confessed to witchcraft. She did so in kaleidoscopic detail with a story about yellow birds and red cats and black hogs. She reported that she'd been recruited by the devil himself, and she'd flown in the wink of an eye to Boston. Moreover, she had accomplices. 3 separate reporters took down her testimony, which created a sensation. Immediately, grown men began to hear unearthly sounds. They met large, winged beasts in the moonlight by the side of the road. And the girl's symptoms spread to a cohort of teenagers, many of them servants. They would play the starring roles in 1692, identifying the witches, displaying bruises and bites and bloodied limbs to the court, and ultimately predicting whom the witches would attack next. They essentially become soothsayers and visionaries, and the court will regularly appeal to them for advice on how witchcraft worked. One man testified that he had wrestled with a black goblin in his parlor. A 14-year-old girl informed the authorities that both her parents were witches, probably not the first girl in history to want to say as much. Fingers soon pointed in all directions. The epidemic spread to 24 communities. We call them the Salem Witch Trials, but Andover, Massachusetts, was the town most severely affected. 1 in 10 of its residents would be denounced. So many stood accused that witnesses began to confuse their suspects. The youngest witch was 5, and the eldest nearly 80. Daughters accused mothers, brothers their sisters, parishioners their ministers. With astonishing frequency, husbands tended to assure the court that they had long suspected their wives to be witches. Let me talk for just a few minutes about witchcraft and about how it worked. What exactly was a witch? To the early American, a witch existed as plainly as did heat or light. As one authority had it, it was as obvious that a witch or a spirit could convey men and women through the air as it was that the wind could flatten a house. The early American witch, I should probably say, did not look like this, although there is something of the Wizard of Oz, a lot of the Wizard of Oz, actually, in the Salem story, and nor did the 17th century witch look like this. This, by the way, is the original Wicked Witch of the West from the 1900 edition of the Wizard of Oz. I particularly like that flying pigtail and the completely unexpected spats on the feet. This is an early American Halloween witch. Witches come late to Halloween, which is celebrated at first without them. And when finally they show up, they dress very colorfully. They don't resort to basic black until after the 1939 Wizard of Oz, Margaret Hamilton movie. The witch, as a 17th century New Englander knew her, was someone who performed unnatural feats by virtue of a contract with the devil. And from that pact, she drew the power to transform herself into cats, wolves, rabbits. A witch could be a man or a woman, though she was more often female. She maintained a menagerie of imps or familiars that did her bidding. And those mascots could be turtles or weasels. Cats, dogs, and toads were prevalent. This 17th century woman is feeding her blood to her diabolical toads. This woman is shown with her great black cat and her demon familiar. She's actually from a 1621 English case, and she's in fact acquitted of all charges. These are more diabolical familiars, and you can see that they range really from your standard issue barnyard pig to fantastical gargoyle-like creatures. A surprising number of Massachusetts men will report in 1692 that they have been assaulted in their beds by cats, by outsized cats, killer cats, glow-in-the-dark cats, neighbors disguised as cats. Black cats were the favorites. They turn up throughout the Salem testimony. And since antiquity, they've enjoyed an association with the devil. Black dogs will recur in the Salem records too, but historically, English witches tended to prefer feline to canine form. This, by the way, is not a witch's familiar. This is our family cat, Moose, but I think looking a little demonic in that photo. A witch signed her pact with the devil in blood and enchanted with ointments and effigies. She could be a muttering, contentious malcontent, or she or he could be inexplicably strong or unaccountably smart. Both kinds of witches turned up in 1692, as would wealthy merchants who were witches, sea captains who were witches, ministers, and homeless five-year-old girls who were witches. Witchcraft tended to run in families along matrilineal lines. There would be a reason why so many of the accused that year were either related to earlier witchcraft suspects or to each other, or both. And while her power was supernatural, the witch's crime was religious. Her ultimate target in New England was the soul rather than the body. The connection then to those convulsing girls? Every Englishman had long known what enchantment looked like. According to the legal guide on many Massachusetts desks, and which was about to land on Samuel Parris's desk, this is the volume by William Perkins, witchcraft manifested in trances, paralyzed limbs, frothing, gnashing, and violent shaking. In other words, the symptoms of the village girls to a T. Perkins has every manner of argument in favor of witchcraft, but possibly the best might be this one. He talks about how, yes, there are indeed counterfeits and frauds in witchcraft stories, but the very existence of those counterfeit stories proves to us the fact that there was such a thing as witchcraft, because otherwise you wouldn't have been able to come up with the counterfeit version. Among the other proofs of her existence was the biblical injunction against a witch. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, commands Scripture. I'm sorry to have to share with you the basic English translation of Exodus 22:18, which is, any woman using unnatural powers or secret arts is to be put to death. That description applies to pretty much every woman I know. When Massachusetts establishes a legal code, the first capital crime was idolatry. The second was witchcraft. I should add that the third was blasphemy, and the fourth, only the fourth, is murder. In the years since those laws had been codified, New England had indicted about 100 witches. Massachusetts had hanged only 6, however. So beside the mystery of the Salem symptoms is arguably a greater mystery: why in 1692 the hasty and merciless prosecution? The charges were familiar from earlier cases. Casting spells on livestock was a fairly common one. Salem witches enchanted fireplaces and muskets and wagons. They sent dishes sailing. They bit and they clawed and they bludgeoned those who refused to sign the devil's book. This woodcut is from an early English case. These accused women did not fare well. Why, you might ask, are they riding a pig? Because they had been accused of pig bewitching. New England witches did a great deal of flying, down chimneys and through apple trees, and ultimately to a diabolical Sabbath. But I should say that traditionally the English witch did not fly. Continental witches, however, did, which would provide a significant clue as to what happened in Salem. Those who confessed to witchcraft that year will mention having flown on the devil's shoulders or on poles, branches, or sticks. No New England witch, alas, ever flies on a broom. These are going to be missing. Oh, no, they're not missing tonight. This is witchcraft. This slide never works. These are witches who are being recruited, it would seem, who are recruiting, it seems, the woman on the ground. This is probably an 18th century woodcut. As far as broomsticks go, this is my favorite. Leave it to a French woman to fly gracefully. This is a 15th century French manuscript. The accepted logic on the phenomenon went like this. Witches existed in all times and places. How is it possible that imagination could deliver the same conceit across all cultures in all eras? In other words, witchcraft was so preposterous, so far-fetched, it had to be true. You couldn't make this stuff up. To the impossibility of a shared delusion, was that the most compelling reason to believe in witchcraft, not to subscribe to it, was heresy. In 1692, then, a witch could be someone who was a foot stamper or a troublemaker, but it could also be someone who simply denied the existence of witchcraft. Faith aside, it served a purpose. It made sense of the unfortunate and the eerie, the sick child, and the disappearing kitchen scissors. What else, shrugged one husband in court, could possibly have caused those black and blue marks on his wife's arms? One more breathtaking thing about the trials. They came to an end because the scope of the crisis taxed the imagination. Could there really be that many witches in Massachusetts? And because of what appeared to be an overzealous court. Carefully, quietly, and anonymously, sane men began to speak up. Few of them, however, questioned the existence of witchcraft. At issue was simply the difficulty in identifying it. Many believed that innocents had died in 1692, but nearly everyone also believed that witches had gone free. To my mind, writers can be spectacularly unhelpful about what nudges them toward a particular subject. I can't say precisely where my interest in Salem took hold, but I can report that you can't head off into the long haul of writing a book without some kind of obsession, the kind that wakes you in the night or that makes you read the news daily through the eyes of someone who lived centuries or hundreds of centuries earlier. As I began thinking about Salem, it felt to me eerily topical and familiar. Oral culture, like internet culture, feeds on rumor. Both effectively sow mass hysteria. We too know a little something about conspiracies and their political utility, about how fear can corrode our thinking, about how raging against the powers of darkness convinces us that we ourselves stand in the light. Here is an instructive tale about a very different war on terror, about the politics of fear, both conducted by the most enlightened men around. Because at the center of events in 1692 were Increase Mather, the most illustrious of Massachusetts ministers, and his brilliant 29-year-old son, Cotton. Cotton Mather had no trouble with the hysteria whipping its way through Massachusetts. He was convinced that the colony was under assault from a subversive crew. More to the point, he relished that attack, which proved Massachusetts' special status. The epidemic seemed to him a badge of honor, further proof that New Englanders were the chosen people. American exceptionalism began here. The civic authorities appealed regularly to the Mathers for guidance in how to prosecute and identify the witchcraft. Those men owned the most extensive collections of printed matter in Massachusetts. They had devoured libraries on the subject of witchcraft. It was to Cotton Mather, in fact, that we owe our knowledge of that earlier Boston epidemic. He had published a best-selling volume on the subject. He wrote more about Salem than anyone else. A decade afterward, he was still puzzling over what could have caused the witchcraft epidemic. He concluded, by the way, that the Native Americans were to blame. One additional thing that may have contributed to the Salem obsession on my part, it's not lost on me that after writing on Ben Franklin's years in France, 8 years for which there's 2.5 times as much documentation as for the rest of his life combined, I wrote A Life of Cleopatra, for which there is not a shred of documentation whatsoever. And after Cleopatra, here with Salem, blessedly, was an archive. It included diaries and sermons and church record books, and best of all, nearly 1,000 transcripts of depositions and petitions and confessions. Here's a page. This is the best of 17th century penmanship. This is from the sermon book of Samuel Parris, the Salem Village minister. This is actually the first sermon in which he mentions the outbreak of witchcraft. As you can see, he does at the beginning when he talks about she-witches in the community having been committed to prison. This is the accounting of one of the many jail keeps who incarcerated witchcraft suspects that year. A 17th century prisoner paid for his bedding and provisions in jail, so the jail keepers tended to be extremely meticulous with their math. So the trial struck me as terrifically urgently relevant, especially when you factored in the general anxiety and the very familiar conspiracy theories. We remain always obsessed with our origins. Thanks in large part to Hawthorne and to Arthur Miller, the trials have really inserted themselves into our DNA. And talking about this book this last year, it has sometimes seemed to me that half of America descends from someone who was in 17th century New England, and the other half of us start in the Crucible in high school. Let me end with the witchcraft confession of a 72-year-old farm woman, because for me she was the start of the story and ultimately of the book. We don't know who initially accused Anne Foster, but we do know that she submitted to three back-to-back, very intense interrogations. At first, she denied having any involvement with witchcraft. Soon, though, she began to unspool an astonishing tale. I should say that by this time, it's midsummer, six alleged witches have hanged. The epidemic takes off at a gallop. It begins in early February, and it lasts altogether only 10 months. The devil, Foster admitted, had appeared to her as a bird, and at his direction, she had bewitched several children and a hog. This is the record of her repeated examinations. This is not the best of 17th century penmanship, and I think I'm showing you this so that you'll feel sorry for me. A neighbor who was a witch had led Foster to a diabolical Sabbath in May, arranging their trip through the air. Foster gave the authorities precise details of that gathering, to which she said witches had flown from all over New England. We can reconstruct that meeting, in fact, from more than 50 sworn testimonies, but alas, we have no image. This is the closest we can come. What timing. This is a 17th century engraving of a German witch's Sabbath. It's a much more decadent production, but certain themes are familiar as these men and women fly by various means to a clearing. You'll remember that I said there had been no flying in Massachusetts before 1692. Well, suddenly that year, everyone is aloft. In her second interrogation, Foster revealed that she'd flown to the meeting on a pole and that she'd shared the pole with one of her neighbors. As they sailed through the air, the two women had crashed. They took off a second time, though Foster hurt her leg in the fall. You see that she's not the first woman to plunge to the ground at such a moment. We knew about her crash not only from that official account, but because a local minister who heard her confess questioned her privately afterward in prison. He was fascinated by the mechanics of witchcraft. Did she ride to the meeting on a stick? What had she done about food? She told him that she had taken bread and cheese in her pocket. She arrived early at the meeting. She reported that she had drunk from a nearby brook, and she described the sandy ground on which she sat. She gave details of the timing of the flights in both directions. As for the accident, the fall from the air, her legs still hurt her. She was completely forthcoming, and she balked only when asked if it was true that she had recruited her own daughter into the satanic conspiracy. That hardly mattered, as the daughter, when arrested, immediately confessed, incriminating her mother as she did so. Foster's 18-year-old granddaughter was also arrested. In court, she assured the authorities that both her mother and her grandmother were witches. But let me go back to Anne Foster's account. To enter into the world of the early American, to grasp what could power a witchcraft epidemic, you need to buy into what we today understand to be a delusion. That was, for me, a new narrative challenge. I was writing a book of nonfiction that had at its center an entirely illusory event. In short, the challenge was to make a crazy thing seem perfectly rational, and then afterward to show why it had been crazy. And Foster's crash seemed to point the way. Here was a woman who not only believed that she had attended a diabolical Sabbath, or had reason to lead others to believe that she had done so, but who had envisioned difficulties getting there and felt she could still feel its after effects. Moreover, that Sabbath stands at the center of the story. The authorities heard that it amounted to a full-blown conspiracy against the state. They were told that the witches were plotting to overthrow both the church and Massachusetts's new government. This was the original plot against America. Anne Foster said there were 25 conspirators. Her granddaughter said 70. Estimates soon rose to 500. Its gravity, in part, explained the ruthless prosecution. The witchcraft had become a political crisis for a colony that felt vulnerable for any number of reasons, having nothing whatsoever to do with witchcraft. All of which convinced me that the book opened with Foster's flight. It sends us into the heart of the matter, and it signals to the reader that odd and seemingly implausible things are afoot. I had to begin then with how Ann Foster traveled from her Andover farm to a diabolical meeting in Salem, 12 miles away. Here then was the initial stab at the first line of the witches. Ultimately, yes, I do write with a pencil on a legal pad. Ultimately, this became the first line of chapter 2, because I much later wrote an introduction to the book, which my canny publisher retitled chapter 1 because, said he, no one ever bothers to read introductions. Should you care to know how long it takes to write a book, it seems that I made this attempt at an opening line on April 8th, 2013. I did not see my children for the next 2 years. By later that day, the line had evolved to this. I had in hand Foster's sworn testimony, along with that account of the minister who had interviewed her in prison. But I also had to check various details. For example, if in fact you flew just above the tree line, southeast from Andover to Salem, what exactly did you see below you? Could you see as far as the ocean in 1692? How lush were those trees? For this, I plagued the Danvers town archivist, who kindly took the question seriously. And of course, I needed to verify the inky night through which they flew. Thereupon followed an extensive correspondence with my favorite research librarian, a man of superhuman tenacity, of which this will give you some idea. This is part of several multi-page emails in which he confirmed for me that, in fact, the night of May 15, 1692 was not inky. A bright gibbous moon shone over Massachusetts that evening. So yes, you're hearing correctly. I spent hours checking the factual circumstances under which a fictive event took place, surely one definition of lunacy. But let me point something else out, too. In trying to recreate Foster's flight, which she had described in such exquisite detail, I had landed in the proverbial wilderness of error. You may have noticed it already. It took me months to see it. Indeed, Foster claimed that she'd flown at high speed over the trees to the Salem gathering. And indeed, she'd done so on May 15th when there was a bright moon in the sky. But nowhere had she said that she made that flight at night. This is the kind of thing that makes you sit bolt upright in bed at 3 a.m., as I did many months after I'd written those lines. I went back and I reread every account of the satanic celebration. Not one of the 52 or 53 included a word about the dark or about navigating the dark. Indeed, no one seemed to have any trouble seeing whatsoever. Some people talked about the color of a satanic wine. Some confessed that they had signed the devil's book in red, all details that they would have had trouble ascertaining by moonlight. In part, I was the victim of my own research. I had wanted to tie Foster's flight to that of another woman who rode through the dark in 1704, if on horseback. I had wanted to stress how much the dark, that velvety, disorienting, sound-amplifying, terrifying blackness, was a player in the story. And after all, everyone knows witches fly at night. Of course, when I went back to look, there it was, Foster's granddaughter plainly tells the justices that the meeting had taken place at noon. And so ultimately, in the final draft, a plush carpet of meadows unfurl below Ann Foster as she flies to Salem, or at least swore she did, over maples and meandering streams. There's a bright moon in the sky, but it is no longer dark. There were, of course, no flights through the air in 1692, nor goblins in the parlor, nor supernatural conspiracies in the meadow. How then did these things seem to happen? When you pry the whole chapter apart, you see that it makes uncanny, really wholly modern sense. I tell you about Foster because I hope you may take from the book what I took from my misreading of her, a reminder of how swiftly we jump to conclusions, how easily both ignorance and information can lead us astray. Fear warps our thinking, preconceived notions trip us up, we leap at explanations. Above all, the Salem history reminds us of the importance of keeping our heads, even when that leaves a question unresolved, even when it leaves us off balance. That's an uncomfortable state, but as a later Bostonian noted, bewilderment is crucial. We'd be lost, in fact, without it. It seems probable, wrote Henry James 200 years after the trials, that if we were never bewildered, there would never be a story to tell about us. Pressed to confess to witchcraft, one suspect told the justices that she was not only innocent, but that she had no idea really what a witch was. Her interrogator, unfortunately, was an expert logician. In that event, he asked, if she didn't know what a witch was, how could she be sure she wasn't one herself? She was the first to hang in June. Her relatives kept their distance. It was safer at that point not to raise one's voice. And nor did anyone seek redress decades later when Massachusetts compensated most of the other families for their losses. That first victim was cleared finally of witchcraft charges in 2001, and naturally she was cleared on Halloween. Thank you.